Spring floods, fall floods.
There's extreme fires, extreme drought.
Extreme weather cost American farmers over $21 billion in 2023.
Our farm is more resilient through the use of cover crops.
These USDA climate programs are good for Main Street America.
Conservation practices that help farmers weather these storms are at risk in the Farm Bill.
If you're smart farming, you're also climate smart farming.
Climate smart farming is just smart farming. Learn more at investinourland.org. Paid for by Invest in Our Land.
I do some Trump. I do some Clay Higgins, my colleague down from Louisiana.
Let's hear the Trump. That's the Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson.
You don't want to hear that. You don't want to hear that today, okay? Because Mike is straight out of Central Casting.
This is true. Johnson is boyish and nerdy and exudes a Southern sweetness that even his most vociferous critics don't deny. And according to his version of Trump,
he's a good Speaker of the House.
That would have been highly debatable not long ago. But Johnson is enjoying a period of renewed respect. Most Republicans are more frustrated with far-right members who make Johnson's life difficult than they are with Johnson. Important voices in the media have praised Johnson for avoiding a shutdown and pushing through aid to Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan. Democrats rewarded him for this streak of responsible governing by saving him from a motion to vacate on Wednesday evening.
They liked him.
Also true, Johnson seems to have picked the lock of Trump relationship management, getting the former president to stand down on the foreign aid package and the motion to vacate. So if that Trump impersonation makes it sound like the speaker is in a good mood, it's because he is. A few hours after the MTV vote, which was defeated by 359-43, my colleague Rachel Bade and I met Johnson in the speaker's suite, where he sat down under a painting of his idol Ronald Reagan and answered our questions for over an hour. We discussed his victory over the GOP radicals, Israel, Ukraine, January 6th, and his relationships with key Washington leaders such as Joe Biden, Hakeem Jeffries, Johnson's predecessor Kevin McCarthy, and of course, Donald Trump. I'm Ryan Lizza, and this is Playbook Deep Dive. Let's start with the motion to vacate.
Mm-hmm.
Big news. Let's start with a lot of the news today. So that resolution said that you aided and abetted Democrats in destroying our country, and 11 Republicans agreed with that and voted not to table it. Which of the 11 Republicans surprised you the most?
You know, I don't know. I haven't even studied the list. I haven't had time. After the vote on the floor, I had a busy schedule tonight, so I've done multiple events before I came to sit down with you.
You want to hear it?
Biggs, no.
Burleson, Crane, Davidson, Gosar, Green, Massey, Mooney, Moore of Alabama, Roy, and Spartz.
I'd say several of those surprised me. I mean, look, those are all friends and colleagues of mine I've worked with a long time. I would not read too much into the voting against the motion to table. In fact, a couple of those folks, Warren Davidson and even Gosar, who was originally with Marjorie and Thomas, Massey and Green on it, told me privately that they lamented that and they would never have voted to vacate and they wished it hadn't happened, but they were, for some reason, they felt like it was important not to go on record against or to be in favor of the motion to table. I don't quite understand the rationale there, but I'll take them at their word. Look, we have a job to do here. We have to govern. I'm glad that that was done. Let's rip the Band-Aid off and get it done. I regret that it had to come to that. I spent a lot of time talking with Thomas Massey and Marjorie Taylor Greene and even Paul Gosar about it. It's the way I operate. It's the way I've been leading since I got the job. I take thoughts, suggestions, ideas from members all the time, almost on a daily, hourly basis, every day. And when they're constructive ideas, we try to implement them. That's how you do this job, especially when you have the smallest majority in U.S. history and a one-vote margin. You need every member on the team to feel like they're contributing and feel like they have a say in it. And so that's what I was doing with them, and I didn't think they would go through with it. But you know what? I went up and talked to all three of the ones who brought the motion, Thomas and Marjorie, too, before we left the chamber. They were some of the last to leave. And I said, you know what? I don't carry grudges, and I'm not angry about this. We have to work together, and I want to work with you guys. And those ideas we were talking about, I'm still working on them. So I hope we can put this behind us and move forward.
Did they say why they chose to do this after saying they'd give you some time to answer their requests?
They didn't have an answer for that. I think I probably surprised them by my approach and demeanor on it. But who knows? I can't get in the mind of anybody else. What I do know is that we have an important job to do here. These are perilous times for the country. The world is on fire. There are hot wars around the globe. We have allies in jeopardy. Our borders wide open. The cost of living is through the roof. The crime rate's through the roof. We're projecting weakness on the world stage. We've got anti-Semitism and angry mobs on college campuses. This is no time for frivolous palace intrigue and politics. We have got to have a functioning Congress. And I think, you know, the landslide vote against removing the speaker is a signal that I think people on both sides of the aisle obviously understand this is not a time for games. We have to do the job here. It's a very important one and a very important and fateful moment in the history of America.
Having said that, I think people are curious to just take us inside these negotiations that you had this week with Massey and Green. Rachel reported that there were at least three demands they had: the Hastert rule, no more aid to Ukraine, and defunding Jack Smith's office. Are those on the table for you?
Well, first of all, there weren't negotiations. I mean, I did to Thomas and Marjorie exactly what I do with all members of the conference. As I said, people come in all the time with ideas and we process them. I don't make snap judgments. On the Hastert rule, as it's called, that means that in layman's terms, you have to have the majority of the majority before you bring something to the floor.
It's the one podcast. You don't have to explain that.
Okay, true. Yeah. That's right. You have a very savvy audience. Thank you for that. Well, but we haven't violated that. I mean, there are a couple of instances where there wasn't the majority of Republicans. One was in the appropriations process. But as I explained to the two of them, we did have a whip count that did have a majority of Republicans. Eight people flipped at the last minute, okay? And that's not something the speaker can control. We didn't break the rule. The Ukraine vote got slightly less Republicans than voted for it, but that vote wasn't whipped. And so the Hastert rule has never been violated so long as I've been involved, and I have no intention of doing so. So agreeing to that wasn't a negotiation. I just affirmed, yeah, I'm already committed to that, and I'm happy to say it. With regard to Ukraine funding, I don't expect that there's any further requests for funding before the end of this year. That was their demand. And I said, I'm already working under that assumption. So you're not asking me to do anything that I haven't already thought and resolved to do. And then with regard to defunding Jack Smith, look, I think that there's been a terrible dereliction of duty with regard to the special counsel and how the whole system has been abused, how they've engaged in lawfare against President Trump. I mean, all of these things are, to me, self-evident truths. But that's not something you wave a wand and just eliminate the special counsel as a provision. It's been part of the law, you know, the tradition and the law here since for 25 years, I think. Before that, it was the independent counsel. And I explained to both of them, as a former constitutional law attorney and litigator myself, there is a necessity for a function like that because sometimes the Department of Justice, which is an executive branch agency, can't necessarily, without a conflict of interest, investigate or prosecute the president who's their boss or the president's family. So you have to have some functioning equivalent of that.
So are you prepared then to stick this into appropriations bills to defund the special counsel?
No, we were in the very beginning stages of even beginning to investigate what that would look like. I mean, I do think there has to be accountability. I do think, you know, Congress has the power of the purse, of course, and we have oversight responsibility. And we've been vigorously using both of those powers that we have. I think we need to look very closely at how we address what I regard to be special counsels that are outside the bounds of what they're intended and supposed to do. But no decisions were made about any of that yet. We were in the preliminary stages. I talked to Jim Jordan about it, who's the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, where I served and was a lieutenant. You know, you have to be very thoughtful about how you handle this. There are problems. We should address them, but we were not yet at any point of conclusion on it.
One other question about the motion to vacate. I want to ask you about the role of former President Trump. He came out full-throated against it, but he also said at some point he may favor a motion to vacate. I have a couple of questions. One is, how did you neutralize former President Trump on this issue? And do you worry about that latter part of the statement that sounds a bit like a threat?
No, I don't take it as a threat. I was with President Trump this past weekend, Mar-a-Lago, and he invited me up on the stage. I was the only other person besides him who spoke, and, you know, when there were potential vice president presidential picks on the stage and lots of our friends. He's been very supportive. I've known him. I know him very well. We've worked together for almost 8 years now. We came to Washington the same time. I've always been very forthright with him and very honest and told him what I thought was in his best interest and the country's best interest, even if sometimes he didn't necessarily agree. And so he often says, Mike is a really good guy. He's doing a really hard job. And I mean, those are, you know, what he means by that is I think we have a very good relationship of trust. And he knows that when I advise him of something or give him an idea or tell him something I have to do, I think he appreciates that I'm operating in good faith. And that means a lot to President Trump. And so we have a very good relationship. I think it's very important in the next Congress. I believe he's going to be elected president again. And I think if I'm serving as speaker and I intend to be, I think he and I having a close relationship will be very important for the country because we have a lot of problems to fix.
Do you agree that some Republicans say that you are only speaker right now because of him? Do you agree with that sentiment?
Well, I don't know. He did throw in an endorsement of me, I suppose, when the speaker's race was ongoing. We all remember well. We closed Congress for 3 weeks because we didn't have a speaker.
Blur.
Yes, it's all a blur to
don't
me, too.
Don't remind us.
The entire last 6 months is a blur to me in some way. But look, this is an important thing to say. I had never aspired to be Speaker of the House. This was not on my bucket list. I was quite content to be a lieutenant. I was on the leadership team. And, you know, I worked to against the vacate motion for Kevin McCarthy. I then worked to get Steve Scalise elected speaker and Jim Jordan and the more senior guys who are very close friends of mine. And it didn't happen. I was sitting in the back of the room as that played out. I had a sense that I could get 217 votes in the room, but I didn't jump forward and put myself out there as a candidate because that's not my way. I had a mentor when I was in eighth grade and they said, Mike, always remember this. Real leadership is recognized and not imposed. And I've thought about that a lot over my life. And I'm not the type of person who puts myself out there and says, I'm going to be the leader. You know, to me, you let other people recognize it and call you forward. And that's ultimately what happened. And we're trying to do the best we can every single day.
I want to move on, but the fact that you mentioned a mentor just reminded me of something. Chip Roy was your mentor when you were a freshman.
Actually, it was the opposite. I was his mentor.
Were his mentor.
I did an exceptional job with that, didn't I?
So does that one sting? Is there a particular sting given that history of that relationship?
It doesn't. Look, I regard Chip as a friend. You know, he's an interesting
character.
You're
very forgiving.
Well, that's my worldview. I'm a Bible-believing Christian. That's one of the first commands we have. You're supposed to love your enemies. Nobody in this building is my enemy. We have a political opposition and people on the other side of the aisle and even sometimes people in our own camp, but they're not enemies. They're all colleagues and friends. I regard them all as such. And the Bible is very clear. You're supposed to bless even those who persecute you. I'm getting a lot of practice in that right now. but there's lots of biblical admonitions that apply here. A soft word turns away wrath. You know, you get a lot further in a legislative body when you can build relationships with people and work on building trust among colleagues. And that's what I do. That's just the way I live. And so I'm not angry at anybody about it. Chip's still going to be my friend. We disagree on lots of policy, but you know, he's a thoughtful guy. I disagree with his tactics quite a bit. And we talk about that. We have what we call in the Deep South intense fellowship about that disagreement sometimes. But it's not personal to me. None of this is personal.
I want to ask you about President Biden's interview with CNN. He told CNN that if Israel invades Rafah, the U.S. will stop supplying it with artillery shells and other offensive weapons. His quote was, if they go into Rafah, I'm not supplying the weapons. Very, very clear. I know you sent a letter about this. What's your view of that?
I was informed about that statement about 10 minutes before I walked in this room, and my reaction honestly was, wow, that is a complete turn from what I had been told even in, you know, recent hours. I mean, 24 hours ago, it was confirmed to me by top administration officials that the policy is very different than what he stated there. So I hope that's a senior moment.
Interesting. Wait, can you just explain that, the difference there?
I was in the skiff having classified discussions with some top administration officials. My concern, I can tell you the subject matter, my concern was, we got word about these, this shipment of munitions being delayed. And that was a great concern to us because I got commitments from top administration officials before we passed the supplemental package for the aid to Israel that would not happen. There would be no delay whatsoever. They repeated to me in writing and verbally. no delay in the delivery of weapons to Israel because it's so desperately needed. I talked with Prime Minister Netanyahu about it, and I wanted to get confirmation from him exactly what's happening. He described exactly what was happening before the news was confirmed. And so I went
before Biden's statement or before?
Well, this is well before Biden's statement, but also before the news broke about those. We were just hearing rumors. Yep. So I confirmed it with Prime Minister Netanyahu. And then I went straight to the White House and I said, what gives? Somebody's going to have to explain this to me because it's very different than what I was told. And they said, oh, this has nothing to do with the supplemental package that you all passed. This is earlier weapons tranches. Well, Israel needs it right now. Well, we're working on that. Well, you better work on it quickly. So this statement by the president, I believe he's off script. I don't think that's something that staff told him to say. I hope it's a senior moment because that would be a great deviation in what is said to be the policy there and in the very critical relationship we have with Israel. This is really, that's really, really big news.
Do you feel betrayed by this then?
I got to say that I do. Yeah. I mean, we've been very deliberate. We've been very open, very much in good faith. The Congress expressed its will through that vote. And so for the administration to make such a huge deviation in policy without, you know, any consultation with us and in defiance of what we quite literally just voted on here days ago, to me, raises a lot of alarm.
Your statement about Biden reminds me of something I think Rachel wanted to ask about that.
Yeah, a lot of your Republican colleagues say that they find Biden to be senile. You've talked a lot with him through these negotiations. Do you agree with that?
I don't know if I'm in any position to diagnose his mental acuity, but I will say it's not personal, but everyone ages differently. It's physiology or what have you. Everybody's different. You know, my father-in-law is the same age as Joe Biden, and he acts as though he's 20 years younger. He's vibrant. He works long days. He still runs his business. I mean, he's on his A game. To be candid, I don't believe President Biden is. It concerns me deeply. I take no pleasure in saying that because I think it's a dangerous thing for the country. I think that our adversaries see him in the same way that many Americans do. And I think that's why our adversaries are acting so provocatively. I believe in Reagan's principles, he reminded us that we maintain peace through strength. And if America doesn't project strength, it's a great concern to free people around the world. And you see the result.
What gives you the impression that Biden has lost a step a little bit with age? What have you seen or heard specifically that makes you think this?
Well, I don't want to violate any personal confidences or anything, but I've had private conversations with him, of course. But I mean, you don't need to rely upon my reflection of a private conversation. You can see him in public and his public statements and
it's
how he handled the
microphone. It's important, though, because you're one of the few Americans who has seen him up close. I mean, you know, some people will maybe think it's partisan, but I do think in this election, that's an important issue.
Again, this is not personal. I have no personal animus against Joe Biden at all. I respect the office, but I do believe that right now, in this fateful moment, you have to have a strong leader in the Oval Office. I mean, we just have to.
One more thing about President Biden. You may not have read this, but Politico reported a very important investigation. If I do say so myself, I didn't write it. That billions of dollars from Biden's four big 2021-2022 legislative packages remain unspent. And we were wondering if you would be willing or have thought about clawing back that unspent money from those four bills and what you might spend it on.
Well, the principle of clawing back unspent dollars is an easy yes, but of course, the devil's in the details. I'm not sure what categories those are, what accounts they're in, what it was dedicated for. If we have the ability to claw it back, we could certainly use that money right now. We got a $35.5 trillion federal debt. This is serious business, and we're working every day on restoring the principles of fiscal sanity here. One of the things we're trying to do, for example, is break up the governance by omnibus. You know, we broke the last spending package at least into two minibuses, and now we're going to actually endeavor to do 12 separate appropriations bills for FY25. That starts today.
How are you going to do that when a bunch of your members are sinking rules left and right? I mean, you guys weren't able to do all 12 appropriations bills last time. What makes you think you can this year?
Well, the reason I'm such an optimist about this is because I handle this situation and this challenge like every other. I mean, we spent time talking with members across the conference. We're going to set up listening sessions when we get back next week to have everybody come in. We'll look at begin with the top line spending numbers, build consensus and agreement on that. We're going to do something that's also innovative. We're going to start with an actual number that everybody can agree to on the front end, not waste time negotiating that. Then the appropriators can begin their process of going through methodically, taking each of the bills, working that through the committee process. And I met with Tom Cole, and he says, we can produce those bills by the end of the summer and get them ready for movement on the floor. We'd like to do that, get it through the House and send it over to the Senate, and then dare Chuck Schumer not to do his job. I think that would be fun for the House to jam the Senate for a change by simply following the law. You know, what a concept.
One follow-up query. Tom Cole said that you guys were going to mark up at bills at the levels that have already been negotiated with Democrats, not try to do this thing that McCarthy did where you cut like $100 billion or some such. Again, how you think Republican conservatives are going to vote for appropriations bills at that level?
Well, I can tell you, I've talked to a number of House Freedom Caucus members and Chip Roy and others, and many of them have already accepted, we call it the FRA number, right? It's the number that was already negotiated. I think it's 1.606 or 1.621 trillion. I can't remember the exact number.
But now you're showing off.
Yeah. But there is a number that everyone has already agreed to. The thing that people rejected last time was the so-called side deals and gimmicks and all the other stuff on the outside. And what the commitment is, what we're trying to do, our endeavor is to actually write the bills at the number that was agreed upon without the other stuff on the side. And I think if there's a commitment on the front end to do that and to maintain that commitment through the House process, I think you'll get a lot of buy-in for it. I mean, I am a fiscal conservative, have been a lifelong fiscal conservative, and this is something that keeps me up at night. I want to get back to the way Congress is supposed to work, and we're going to try to force that.
Here in eastern Colorado, we just left a fairly serious drought period, and our water improvements funded by the USDA were likely the sole reason that we were able to stay in business.
Extreme weather cost American farmers over $21 billion in 2023.
Spring floods, fall floods, we lose part of a crop just about every year.
There's extreme fire, there's extreme drought, storms, tornadoes, and everything.
With these programs, we're saving the soil, and we're saving our nutrients that we're putting on the soil.
Our sugar beets have gone from 18 ton to we're pushing 35 to 40 ton now.
Conservation practices that help farmers weather these storms are at risk in the Farm Bill.
We've been here for over 170 years, five generations, and hopefully, you know, we can continue on the legacy.
If you're smart farming, you're also climate smart farming.
Climate smart farming is just smart farming. Learn more at investinourland.org. Paid for by Invest in Our Land.
We wanted to ask you about some of your fellow leaders in Congress. And let's start with Hakeem Jeffries. Mm-hmm. Like you, he's a religious man. Have you gotten to know Jeffries as a brother in Christ?
I have, yeah, I have. And Hakeem is a good man. I mean, he's... We've worked well together. We have a lot more in common than people might think. He's from New York and I'm from Louisiana. I think while we have lots of disagreements on policies and the fine points of policy, I think you can appreciate people for who they are as a person. I think that's what we're called to do. He and I both kind of share the worldview on that. I can appreciate that he's a good family man. We have a lot in common in that regard. And he lost his father recently. I lost mine 3 days before I got elected to Congress. You know, we've talked about that. We've talked about how he and I both came to our leadership positions in a rather circuitous fashion that neither of us predicted or expected in terms of timing and how we would be elevated as we were. He's been here a little bit longer than I have been, but there are things that we have in common. And I think what we've appreciated about one another is that I believe that when Hakeem Jeffries is telling me something, I believe he's telling me the truth. I believe he's a man of his word. And I think he believes that about me as well. And that's a big thing in Washington. You know, trust is a rare commodity around here. And while we don't agree on many things, it's really refreshing to sit across the table from someone who is your political adversary and know that they're shooting straight. And I mean, I wish that we could have a lot more of that around here because it would solve a lot of problems. Look, I'm a Reagan Republican. I love the way he did the job. He was a happy warrior, you know, and he and Tip O'Neill.
This portrait, listeners should know, is hanging here in the conference room. You decided that, obviously.
Yeah. I did. I got Reagan and Washington. And oh, there's another Reagan. I'm trying to find a good
Lincoln. Wasn't left over from like Pelosi, right?
No. I brought all those in. No, he was a hero to all of us. I think all Republicans, he's still the standard bearer. And the reason is because the way he did the job, he's very principled. But he didn't hate anybody, right? So anyway, Reagan and Tip O'Neill famously had this great relationship. And after his assassination attempt, Tip O'Neill goes to the hospital and kisses him on the forehead. You know, like, they didn't agree on almost anything, but they had respect for one another. And I think we got to get back to that. I think America needs more of that. The person on the other side of the aisle is not an enemy. They're a fellow American. Our enemies are like Hamas and Hezbollah and, you know, the people who are trying to kill us. These are our political adversaries. But the way the system is set up, the founders anticipated that you'd have people with very different philosophical ideas, very different principles and ideas about government. But the point was that we would come here, sit around a table and arm wrestle together and kind of get to a point of consensus so that we can govern the country. I mean, these things are lost on people now, but this system doesn't work unless you understand the principles that undergird it. And I think restoring those principles is really important for this institution to endure.
You talk about Republicans you admire. Let's talk about a more controversial Republican leader, McCarthy. When you were elected Speaker, did he ever call you and offer any advice? Did you ever seek his counsel?
He did early on. I mean, look, I was on the leadership team under Speaker McCarthy. I was the vice chairman of the House Republican Conference, and it's the number six leadership position. It was funny because when I became Speaker, I said, who is this mysterious man? I was like, I've been on leadership for 3 years. You guys didn't know what the vice chairman of the Republican Conference is. Come on.
Wow.
Yeah, right. I know. It was meaningless, but I was on the team. I was at the table, and I was trying to help advance the agenda, and I'm a lifelong movement conservative, so I was always trying to advance those principles. And, you know, Kevin was good to me. And it was a very painful thing that happened to him. I mean, it was an unprecedented thing. I mean, vacating the chair was devastating to all of us. I mean, it was like being part of a traumatic experience that lasted and endured for too long. And so, there was a lot of pain for him personally, I'm sure, that came out of that. But in spite of that, I went to his spoke at his farewell party that they threw for him, his big gathering, and, you know, a couple weeks later, and he reached out multiple times in the beginning to offer assistance and try to help. To his credit, I mean, you know, that was a tough thing. It's a tough thing. And he knew that I had no ulterior motive. I was never involved in, you know, trying to remove him or anything. And I think we still have that mutual respect. And
can I ask you, where do you think McCarthy went wrong as Speaker? And what are you doing to sort of make sure you don't fall into those traps?
It's not my place to judge my predecessor. I think because our margin was so small and Kevin had such a difficult time obtaining the gavel in the first place, we went 15 rounds, right, before he was elected Speaker. He had a challenge from day one. And when they reduced the motion to vacate threshold to one, it was always a sort of Damocles hanging over his head. So I have a lot of sympathy for Kevin or anybody who serves in a position like this at a time like this with all those factors. It's extremely difficult to do and to navigate those tough waters. So it's not my place to judge him. I think history will record he did the best he could under the circumstances, and that's exactly what I'm trying to do every day.
It's interesting to hear you talk about bipartisanship and this respect for the famous relationship that Reagan and Tip O'Neill had. We're not really living in those times these days, obviously. And one of the biggest sources of friction in the country is the aftermath of the 2020 election in January 6th. Do you have any regrets about the role that you played after the 2020 presidential election, including the amicus brief in support of Texas's lawsuit challenging the election results?
No, I don't. My point in the amicus brief, and people often ask me about this and they never read the brief, right? We add a little bit more to it, but it was a very simple and very profoundly important legal question. And that is, was the plain language of the Constitution violated in the days that led up to the 2020 election? And it very clearly was, because the language of the Constitution says plainly the state legislatures are the bodies in each of the states that determine the process by which electors are chosen. In a presidential election year, it's a critically important thing. The operative language there is state legislatures. It doesn't mean election officials, secretaries of state, governors, or any other body. It has to be the state legislature to be ratified. And what happened because of COVID, it was the COVID election year. Everything was different. Everything was irregular. Some in good faith and others not in such good faith began to act at state levels to change their laws. Some of them in good faith, they thought, well, I know it's April and we're in the first couple of months of COVID, but my goodness, what if it lasts till November? This is a presidential election year. How will people vote? Well, maybe we should do mail-in ballots to every voter in the state. Maybe we should put unmanned drop boxes in public parks for people to drop off their ballots. Maybe we should do all these things. Some of that was well-intended, perhaps, but the problem is none of that was ratified by state legislatures because the legislatures weren't meeting and they don't do proxy voting. That plainly, clearly violated the plain language of the Constitution. Now, remember, my background is a constitutional law attorney. For 20 years, I litigated constitutional questions in the courts. And to me, this was such a plain and very important question to be answered. And the only mechanism we had to present that to the highest court in the land, the Supreme Court, was to attach it along to that Texas case that was going to be before the court. That's why the amicus brief was filed there. The Supreme Court dodged the question. Perhaps they calculated that the answer was so profound, it would be so unsettling that it was not worth them addressing. But
well, it's also the question of whether there was any remedy. As you know, that's the big issue, right?
Maybe so. But listen, I think fidelity to the Constitution, even in difficult times, is critically important for us. And I thought that was an important question to pose to the court. And so you asked me if I regret that. I don't. I would do the exact same thing today if the circumstances were presented. Because I feel like I have a duty. I'm an officer of the Congress, and I have a responsibility. We take an oath to uphold the Constitution. And if it's plainly on its face not being followed, I have an obligation as an officer of this body to present that to the judicial branch. That's
so
what we did.
If you were Speaker on January 6, 2021, would you have done anything differently?
I don't know. You know, I've never tried to assess that. That was an unprecedented moment at a very difficult time in the country, and I'm not sure what I would have done at that point.
On aid to Ukraine, one thing I wanted to ask, just what was the single most important thing you learned about that war that convinced you that $60 billion needed to be sent to Ukraine?
Great question. So when I became Speaker, I was elected October 25th to be Speaker. The very next morning, I was summoned to the Situation Room at the White House. I sat down with President Biden for a few moments. We had a little meet and greet there, and then I met with the entire, you know, team there. I had, over the course of 2 days, I had conversations with the Secretary of Defense, the Secretary of State, the National Security Advisor, you know, everybody. I delivered by hand a list of 14 questions that House Republicans had composed with regard to the Ukraine question, because the president had already requested the supplemental and needed money, and we said, here's the problem. You have not defined for us. The White House has done a terrible job messaging this. What is the necessity of the funds? Where will they go? How will there be accountability? What is the strategy? What's the end game here? Like, we're Congress. We're supposed to know this. Please answer these questions. For probably 4.5 months, they dithered on providing those very simple answers that were necessary for us. I don't think they had it all figured out. They did piecemeal. They answered partial questions. We sent back further explanation, all that. But in the final weeks of April, it was widely understood by everybody that Ukraine was quite literally going to run out of defenses. They're going to run out of ammunition. I mean, in layman's terms, they're done. End of April. We knew that was the, pardon the pun, but the drop dead date, right? And so that was the pressure valve, and we knew that we were coming up to the end of that, and the White House understood it as well. So in the last probably, I don't know, 7 to 10 days prior to the end of April, we suddenly began to get lots of the questions answered because it was so urgent. Meanwhile, I was receiving classified briefings from, you know, our top generals who were our generals who were in control of that region and from our own intel officers, not deep state briefings. I was talking to people that I know and trust, you know, Mike Pompeo, who's the Trump Secretary of State. I talked to John Ratcliffe, who's the DNI under the Trump administration. I mean, conservatives, people that I know and trust, and many others. And they all confirmed what we were seeing and hearing, and that this was a desperate thing, and time was of the essence. And so the combination of all those factors and understanding as well, remember at that time, Iran had openly and directly fired on Israel. I believe there truly is an axis of evil. I believe Ukraine, China, and Russia, and sometimes North Korea are in collusion on something. I think they're working together. I think they're funding one another's aggressions and all these things. And so I thought the signal was very important that we needed to send to the world that we're not going to shrink back. America is going to project strength. And we needed to send that message to Xi in China and Vladimir Putin and Iran and anybody else who thinks that we would not do what must be done. And so that's what would happen. Now, remember, of the $60 billion, 80% of that money is for the replenishment of our own weapons and stockpiles and operations. The other 20%, as you know, we converted to a loan. And so it's forgivable by a future president in the next administration, and I think I know who that's going to be. It would be a good chip in the game for President Trump to have when he is the strong man who goes to the negotiating, forces everybody at the negotiation table and tries to force a peace on that. I think he has the ability to do that. And we also put in other innovations. We had the Repo Act, which, you know, you take the seized assets of corrupt Russian oligarchs, all these other things. And also, this is important, we put in that legislation that's signed into law 45 days from the day that it became law. The White House has to give us a detailed, full plan of in-game strategy, accountability, and all the rest. All right. I think those are important things to do.
In our final moments here, we'll do some like lightning round questions.
Okay.
Quick stuff.
Oh God,
so
round.
Do you anticipate putting forward any legislation on abortion before the election?
No.
If there is Republican control of both chambers of Congress and the White House piggybacking off abortion, do you anticipate passing any sort of nationwide abortion ban?
No, I don't. Look, President Trump said this is in the state's purview now after the Dobbs decision. I think that's where it is. Look, I'm a lifelong pro-lifer. I'm a product of a teen pregnancy. And so I believe in the sanctity of human life. It's also an important article of faith for me. But I have 434 colleagues here. You know, all of us have our own philosophical principles that we live by, but you have to have political consensus. Breitbart said politics is downstream from culture. He's right. Before you can have political consensus on a very contentious issue like this, you have to have cultural consensus. And I think there's a lot of work to do to build a cultural life and to educate people on the importance of that and to really live up by the principles of our nation's birth certificate, which is the declaration that all men are created equal. And there's value in that. But we have a long way to go to build the political consensus here to do anything in that regard.
Do you think the president should have absolute immunity from prosecution?
Which president and when? That's a loaded question.
A right? President of the United States.
Well, certainly.
I think you know the origin of this question.
Yeah. Certainly when a president is serving in office, there must be an immunity clause. Because otherwise, he would be looking over his shoulder on every critical
But not
decision.
Absolute immunity. Come on.
I do think it's important. I mean, whoever is the commander in chief, if you're elected by all the people in this country, you should be trusted with the office. And we need the person, having given them that trust, to be able to make critical decisions on a dime without worrying about some sort of liability for it. I think that's
but
a really important principle.
Absolute immunity as a constitutional scholar yourself?
It's not a question I've wrestled with. I might write you a long dissertation on it. Give me some time to think it through. But I think as a general premise, I think it makes sense to most people. I think it's common sense that you can't have the president sitting in the Oval Office worried about whether some lawyer or some local DA somewhere is going to go after him. I think that's it'd be a serious problem.
All right. This is going to be one of the strangest segues ever. But you were a high school thespian and you're well known for your political impersonations. What is your best impersonation of a politician?
I do some Trump. I do some Clay Higgins, my colleague down from Louisiana.
Let's hear the Trump. The Trump.
You don't want to hear that. You don't want to hear that today, okay? Because Mike is straight out of Central Casting. You don't want to hear that. He's a good Speaker of the House. I've liked him. I always knew he was going to be Speaker. No, you didn't, Mr. President.
Have you done it for him?
I don't know if I have done it for him. I've done it for a lot of other people. Look, flattery
do you feel like he's got
imitation is the greatest form of flattery.
But do you feel like he's got enough of a sense of humor that he would be okay
with
it?
Oh yeah, no, he would laugh. We have a good time together. We had dinner
he wouldn't
together.
Call for the motion to vacate.
No. I think he'd be flattered by it. And people love that. It humanizes him, and I think he's got thick skin. He's fine.
You think Donald Trump has thick skin?
I do. I really do. Look,
the things about Donald Trump, I don't think anyone's ever accused him of having thick skin.
Well, they're not assessing what he's been enduring. I've been taking arrows here for 6 months. Donald Trump has taken nuclear incoming every single day since he came down the Golden Staircase. I mean, you can't say that guy's not tough as nails. I mean, no one else could endure what he has had to endure. Nobody.
All right. Fair enough.
Let's talk about a future Speaker Johnson. You have said that you are planning to lead the conference beyond November. But you also said it's your job to keep the majority. So if you lose the majority, will you step down from leadership?
I haven't crossed that, come to that bridge to cross yet. I'm working very hard. My team calculated after we left Mar-a-Lago this past weekend that I'd been to 101 cities in the last 5.5 months and over half the states. We're working around the clock, quite literally every day, to ensure that we grow the majority. I'm convinced, however, I am very bullish on November. I think the House Republicans are going to grow the House majority. I think we're going to retake the Senate, and I think Donald Trump's going to be the president again. So that's what motivates me to go forward. I think there's hope for all this, but I have to focus on what I have in front of me today, and I'll worry about the rest of that later.
We do this thing on this show where the last question is always something from our previous guest, who happened to be Jerry Nadler.
Ah.
Who had some pretty nice things to say
fellow
about you.
Fellow constitutional law.
Yes. We used to, have our sword fights in Judiciary Committee.
Led the opposition to the anti-Semitism bill.
Yes.
He didn't know this was going to be you, but his question was, what do you think is the future of democracy in this country? And then we'd like you to propose a question for our next guest.
Okay. Future of democracy in America. Let me tell you.
It's like more of an essay question.
Yeah, it kind of is. Let me try to be concise.
But it is a big issue.
Sure, it's a big issue. I am very bullish on the future. I genuinely believe what Reagan said, actually Lincoln said it first, but Reagan reminded us that we are the last best hope of man on the earth. This constitutional republic that we have, grand experiment on the world stage. We turned 248 years old July 4th. It's a big birthday for us. We're coming up on 250 years. That is about the average lifespan of many great societies and cultures. And we're coming to a moment. Dr. Oz Guinness is a author, friend of mine, and he wrote a book.
You had him on your podcast last year.
I did. You heard that? Yeah, he's brilliant. He has an English accent, so he always sounds smarter than everybody he's talking to. But he describes this as a civilizational moment. And he's a historian, a social scientist of sorts. And he says that there comes a moment in a great society when there's a civilizational moment where the people have to decide whether they're going to tie themselves in more again to the founding principles that made that great society, or they're going to jettison that in exchange for something else. And he makes the point that over history, every time the jettison has happened, it's destroyed the culture. We have to make that decision now. I genuinely believe we can solve all these great problems that are challenging us right now. And that's why I get up and go to work every day. I mean, I have four children. I'm deeply concerned about what they're going to inherit. What are they going to have the same liberty, opportunity, security that we've had? And that's a real live question for my family as it is for millions of others. And that's what's worth fighting for. So what's the future of American democracy? I think this republic is going to endure. And I think that's why we're the model for every other country around the world. You might have noticed there is no other country that has hundreds of thousands of people every month trying to get through their borders and get in. They want to come here because we're the best, and we better stand by it and make sure that can survive.
Can I just ask one quick follow-up on that, if you'll indulge me? On one of those podcasts, you noted that Trumpism was necessary, but that you were also concerned about what is being lost from traditional conservatism. What do you think is being lost?
So another long answer, I'll make it quick. But so in 2019, I got elected to be chairman of the Republican Study Committee. It's the largest caucus of conservatives in Congress. At that time, we had 158 members, all the self-described conservatives in the House are part of that group. And I got elected chairman. I was in my second term of Congress, which is sort of unusual because it's the big caucus. And so I stood in front of my peers and I said, gee, thanks for making me the chair. I said, here's what I want to posit to you all. This is 2019, 2 years into the Trump administration. Lots of furniture is being moved around. Some's being broken. There's a big, it was a tumultuous time in the country for lots of reasons. And I felt like a lot of people back home and some of my own colleagues in the building, we were losing our sense of who we are. Like, what does it mean to be an American conservative? And it's a live fire question right now. And I said, look, you guys know me, my background, I have a huge toolbox of totally unmarketable skills, but I was a constitutional law attorney for a while and an amateur historian, and I've been thinking about this for a long time. And I'm concerned that we're sort of losing. I said, y'all forgive me, I'm from Louisiana. Everything's explained in either a football or a hurricane metaphor, but using the hurricane metaphor, hey, we're in uncharted waters. We feel like we're lost the rudder and we're afloat on this tumultuous sea. You better know where the fixed points are on the horizon. And I said, so if it was up to me, I think if we created a working group to come up with a definition of American conservatism today, I think it would come down to a simple list. I would posit to you what I call the seven core principles of American conservatism. I said, I think it boils down to this: individual freedom, limited government, the rule of law, peace through strength, fiscal responsibility, free markets, and human dignity. We need to be able to speak with greater clarity, conviction, and consistency right now than we ever have, because people need answers. And we can't go out and just say what we're against. We have to say what we're for. And I believe, I call them the core principles of American conservatism, but I actually think they're the core principles of America. I think that's the reason that we became the great nation that we are. And I think we're losing it. And so our challenge today is to be able to define that.
All right. That's not Trump's list, though.
Well, no, I think it is. I think he's pursuing most of those principles. I really do. Now, he might define it differently, as many colleagues and conservatives do, but we have people in the building who have disdain for those founding principles. I mean, openly. They would rather trade those for something else. They envision for us that we should be some sort of European-style socialist utopia or something. I believe that's a fool's errand. And so my job every day is to, in the most winsome way I can, to be a happy warrior, as Reagan envisioned, to try to advance and advocate for those core principles that I think are going to help us save the Republic. I think it's a really important job that we have.
What do you want us to ask our next guest?
That's a good one. How about this? How about what makes you proud to be an American? That's a good one.
What's your answer?
The idea that we do live in the greatest country in the history of the world. I don't even think it's close. And I don't have any problem defending that. You know, I'm a lawyer, and if you gave me time, I'd put on my full case to prove it.
Well, congrats on still being speaker.
Yeah, thanks.
And thanks for an excellent conversation.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Thanks for being here.
And that's our show. Our producer is Kara Tabor. Our senior producer is Alex Keeney. I'm Ryan Lizza, host and executive producer of Deep Dive. Our music is by the mysterious Breakmaster Cylinder. Please tell us what you think about the show or who you'd like to hear on Deep Dive. You can email me at rlizza@politico.com. And please subscribe to Playbook Deep Dive wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.